Welcome, everyone, to the second episode of Frost Christmas. Last week, we talked about 70s paranoia films, and this week, we thought it would be a good idea to sort of introduce the listeners who seem to have a great reaction. We got some good press. It seems like people are excited about the podcast, as we are, and we want to let you guys sort of know what we're into, what kind of films we like, what our aesthetic sensibilities are, so that you can kind of know, you know, if you're on our wavelength, so you don't get mad at us if you disagree with us, that kind of thing. So for this episode, we're going to go through and go back and forth on some of our favorite movies, some of the movies that we don't like that are maybe universally acclaimed, you know, personal stuff from film that we all respond to, and like the kind of things that really hit our sweet spot when it comes to films. So with that in mind, let's start off. Amber.
Hey.
Let's go through our list of our favorite movies. We'll go back and forth on that.
Okay. So I think we both agreed early on that this is like not a comprehensive list at all, but
absolutely not.
It's a sampler.
Right. And not like we're not making any claims that these are the best movies.
The movies we love.
We are the movies that we have personal feelings towards. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Movies that changed our lives.
Yes.
So I went through, I did like the Twitter seven favorite things, and I actually like went back and I rethought them, and a lot of the ones that I came up with remained on like my secondary list that I made for the show. So Night of the Hunter is always something that comes up for me. It's one of my, it's one of my like date movies, like where if I decide if I respect a man artistically or not, I make him watch that movie. I do gravitate sort of towards horror and body horror. Eyes Without a Face was like, I think I saw it 2 years ago, and it's a French movie, and my roommate at the time, this was not Felix, there was a before Felix, my roommate at the time was like, we should watch something scary from the Criterion Collection. So we're like, okay, let's watch this arty fucking French movie. We won't be scared. It's from like 1960. Who cares? It's just absolutely troubling. It's a very troubling movie. It's so good. So within that, Dead Ringers. I love sort of that intensity. So I love Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I love All About Eve. I love Sunset Boulevard. You'll notice I like a lot of feminine and gay films. My tastes skew very femme. I really like camp, which is kind of an unpopular thing. So I like a lot of musicals. I like American in Paris. I like Singing in the Rain. I like Cabaret and Meet Me in St. Louis. I think Fran Lebowitz once said something about how there was like a professional arts audience that was like eviscerated by the AIDS epidemic. And it is true. And sort of as a result, we kind of have a historiography of cinema that's like more masculinist than it actually was. So yeah, I'm going to be forcing Matt to watch some gay ass films in the future.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Yeah. I love a lot of sort of irreverent comedy. I love all Mel Brooks, even the bad ones. But
Young Frankenstein. Even Dracula Dead and Loving It?
I mean, look, you're not going to judge me for this.
I was not judging. I was clarifying. I just wanted to know, yes or no, even Dracula
knowing,
Dead and Loving It.
Knowing that I saw it under the age of, I think, 13.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. You see a movie young enough, it is inoculated in your mind for all time for criticism.
That said,
at Spaceballs.
Yeah,
Spaceballs isn't that much better.
It's
than
not
Dracula Dead and Loving It, but more people saw it at a formative age and they will defend it with their life because of that.
That said, Young Frankenstein holds up.
Absolutely,
it holds up hard.
His early production is that Blazing Saddles, the producers.
Yes, absolutely.
You can't step to it.
So taking a hard turn from that, I had Rosemary's Baby on my list, which is still one of my favorite favorite movies of all time. I think it was interesting that The Babadook came out recently, and I saw that as very much, like, following in that tradition of, like, feminine horror and fear of the monster baby.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I love that shit. Yeah. I also love Eraserhead for the same reason.
Right, yeah, the anxiety of childhood and being a parent.
And
yeah.
having this horrible creature that maybe it's evil.
Yeah.
I like a lot of bleak westerns. I love High Plains Drifter. I love Network. I love
Network Rules.
Yeah,
we will be doing an episode about Network. There's no question about it. Network is so great.
It's evergreen.
It's evergreen. It's one of those rare, really on the nose satires that has only gotten more pointed over time. It hasn't aged. And even though it's like almost totally just a succession of speeches.
Yeah.
Very little, like, character dynamic. It's like people give speeches to one another. The speeches are all awesome.
Oh, they're so good.
They're so great.
But what's horrifying, though, is it's one of those movies where everyone misses. It's a total Scarface, where
everyone
doesn't get, this is a cautionary tale. You know that, right? Like, everyone romanticizes it, and it's incredibly disturbing.
Yeah. No, and for me, that movie's, the peak for that is the Ned Beatty speech.
Oh my God.
To Howard Beale, where he explains the world.
Uh-huh.
And it made sense in 1970s, but now it's just eerie.
And like, you know, Sidney Lumet, he had no idea. He had no idea how real it is.
I mean, he was living in a world that still was divided by, supposedly by the ideological, conflict of the Cold War.
Yeah.
But even at the time, he's like, What do they sit down with their councils of state? Do they talk about Karl Marx?
Yeah.
They get out their linear programming projections just like we do. And now, in an era, a generation removed from the fall of the Soviet Union, it's only more accurate.
Yeah.
Great movie.
One
on my list, too, so I won't talk about it.
So I like that. I like Dystopia. Matt and I both love RoboCop.
Oh, God. Another one on my list, so I won't talk about that one.
Speaking
of episodes, Verhoeven. We haven't talked about how we're going to do it yet, because it could be a two-hour episode, but there will be a Verhoeven episode.
Yeah. We both sort of acknowledge that we're both, like, Americanists.
Yeah, that's part of what this episode is putting our cards on the table. And one of them is that, you know, there are people who earnestly love all types of cinema, world cinema, cinema from the, you know, silent age to now. And I like movies in all of those traditions, but the movies that speak to me most viscerally tend to be made in America by Americans and reflect American culture. And I kind of can't think of any way that wouldn't be true, because we're talking, as we said, about visceral responses.
Yeah.
And if someone's speaking in your cultural language, it's much more powerful.
Oh, totally. That said, like, there are some I love. I said I'm attracted to a lot of, like, despair. So I love Ingmar Bergman. Really can't beat him on despair. I've probably seen The 400 Blows a million times. I like Kurosawa. I like, a few movies by Guru Dutt, even though I find a lot of Bollywood completely impenetrable. but I do recommend Guru Dutt, who is, like, I guess a director that's supposed to, he's supposed to be the Orson Welles of India.
Right.
And, like, you can see it and watch it. You're like, okay.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the most palatable to, like, my very American brain.
Yeah.
Okay. How about you?
Okay. Well, I'll start off by saying that one of the things that's going to be interesting about this podcast is even though we're both broadly responding to American films, and we find those the most sort of absorbing to our imaginations and the ones that we think about the most, we certainly have, there's some overlap, but there's also a lot of difference. Amber, of course, talking about her love of camp and musicals and
gay ass shit,
in other words. And I am, and this is a warning to everybody, turn off the podcast if you need to. I am very much more a stereotypical, even, I would say, dude.
You're a high T man.
I'm a high T male when it comes to film. Car crashes, explosions, if there's a gun in it, I will be more interested than if there isn't a gun in it. It's embarrassing, because I want to be a well-rounded, cultured individual in the 21st century.
Your guns are my glorious Swanson in a long silk negligee.
Right. So, I'm a dude. To give you an idea of how much of a dude I am, when I was in college, I had a poster on my wall of the scene in Goodfellas where Joe Pesci shoots Spider. He's like pulling the gun out, and it says like, "You gonna let him talk to you like that?" You know how they had poster day, first week of school? It's like, hey kids, put something on your wall to approximate a personality. And I said, I saw this thing, and I'm like, yes, that's worth putting on my wall.
I'm trying to remember what I had. I had a train spotting poster on my wall.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was like, that's in the same heroin and Iggy Pop. Yeah. That's what I like.
That's in the same ballpark, you know, 90s sort of indie, but a little bit more, yeah, sort of more tragic.
The sort of romance, thing that an 18-year-old like loves.
More about, yeah, like fetishizing like a lifestyle and a lifestyle that one might want to partake in or find interesting as opposed to just me, which was just voyeuristically getting off on horrible violence.
Yeah.
But like I swear to God that I have matured in my taste since then. I like a more wide variety of things. But the things I love spring from that doodly high tea thing. I saw Pulp Fiction when I was like 12 in the theater, and it did way too much to forge my aesthetic taste for me to deny
it. I still love Pulp Fiction, yeah.
It's a really good movie. It's hard to watch now. I have a friend who has never seen it. And I've sold them. You don't need to see it because you will not be able to watch it. You will be watching it like refracted through 20 years of culture.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's no way to like actually
you can't decontaminate yourself of all the influences that it's produced.
And that is why this is another idea for an episode that I want to do in the future. And this will be tough just because watching the movies is going to be hard because they're bad. Mm-hmm. And that is to watch all of the indie Tarantino knockoffs that came out in the 90s in the wake of Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Because I, as a Tarantino-obsessed idiot, watched all of them.
Okay.
Okay? Sure. I'll give you some titles, and I bet you've not seen any of them, but they're all terrible. They're all they try way too hard with making the dialogue clever. Mm-hmm. It's all about, like, hitmen and shit. Like, probably the best one is Gross Point Blank.
I liked Gross
Point Blank. I like Gross Point Blank. It works. You can argue it's not a Tarantino ripoff.
It works because John Cusack kind of carries it.
But yeah, but I mean, like, come on. It came out a few years after Pulp Fiction. It's got a hitman hero. It's a Tarantino knockoff. But it's probably the best one.
Yeah.
But the bad ones. There's one with Andy Garcia, and they all have really pretentious titles. One with Andy Garcia called Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
I love Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
What?
No, I can't help it. I love it.
Oh, my God.
I can't help it.
Steve Buscemi is Mr. Hush or whatever.
It's because
the silent assassin.
It's because I like the performances in it. And
well,
I
everyone's chewing scenery. Jack Warden.
Oh
that
my
must
God.
Have been like his last performance. He's just like this giant rock man. He's got that Lawrence Tierney and Reservoir Dogs vibe of just this, just this monstrous human.
It's
gurgling out his dialogue through like 500 pounds of like lung cancer.
I enjoyed it. I still. Enjoy
I haven't seen it since I was a teenager.
I bet I would
appreciate rewatching that one. Then.
Yeah, it's
because,
fun.
Because, yeah, Warden's good. Treat Williams as, like, the psycho from prison.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. But, like, it's got that overly clever dialogue.
Yeah.
Where people are trying to be Tarantino.
It's a little too clever by
but
half.
They can't.
Yeah.
Because that was written by the same guy who wrote Con Air.
Really?
Yes, which is another movie that has that super obnoxious, overly stylized dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a line in Con Air that has stuck in my head since I saw it in the theater as an example of try-hard dialogue. And it's when Nick Cage is trying to stop Ving Rhames from shooting the hostages that they have from the plane. They're all prison guards. And Malkovich says, "My own proclivities are well-known and oft-lamented facts of penal lore." And I just...
Oh,
like,
my God.
How did he, like, how many times did they have to get that take?
That's, like, something that, so I teach, freshman writing at NYU.
Yeah.
That's, like, the one kid who was, like, the best writer in his class. That's how they,
right.
Like, he has a thesaurus and he got A's for having a thesaurus.
Yep.
And, like, that one of the first things I do to those kids is
you gotta
knock
break
that
them.
Shit
you have
out
to break them. Because... Yeah, there's like two kinds, really, of the precocious kid.
Because you appreciate the ambition.
Exactly. The precocious, ambitious young writer they either get stuck into that, in mm-hmm. which case they're insufferable and they yeah. write Con Air, or they move beyond it. And yes. then they look back on that stuff with embarrassment, which yeah. they should.
I feel like you should have had someone make you embarrassed of that before you made Con Air.
Absolutely. another one, I don't think you've seen this one. I'd be surprised if you had. I was already shocked that you've seen Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
I hang out with boys.
Apparently. Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
No.
Okay, that is Kiefer Sutherland, only one of two movies directed by Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, dear.
Starring Vincent Gallo.
Oh, my God.
And Martin Sheen. And it's about a heist gone wrong.
Okay, so, like, you have, like, three men who take themselves very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
Like, all of those men are incredibly yes. self-important.
Yeah. yeah. Well, that's what's so funny about it, because it has the Tarantino template, but no humor at all.
Yeah.
And there's an attempted humor where basically they rip off the scene from True Romance where Walken goes to see Dennis Hopper uh-huh. and kills him. And it's Max Perlick is the guy who's been captured, and Martin Sheen is the bad guy who shows up. And they torture him while playing some pop song. I can't remember which
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, come on.
You're not even trying.
You're trying
yeah.
so hard, but not hard enough.
Yeah.
But, like, those, that's the genre. And I think that'd be really interesting to look at, because they're just so painfully derivative, and it's just like, hey, that's what people like. You guys like hitmen in your independent movies? We got hitmen for you.
Yeah.
We got botched heists.
Yeah.
How's it going? You like us yet? Yeah. Please. And the
this
funny
is
thing
pop
is...
music playing
And
in
the thing
background.
Is that they filled the gap of Tarantino, because Tarantino went, like, 5 years. Like, the whole half, last half of the 90s. Didn't make anything before Jackie Brown came out in, like, 98.
Yeah.
So it's like that hole got filled by all these people trying way too hard.
Like, what, yeah, like you said, but there's some humor to Tarantino.
Oh, that, absolutely.
Like, you can't, he got laughs out of, you know,
yeah.
like,
no, I will stand up
know?
For those movies. I think Tarantino's very talented, and I think that his, like, emotional immaturity, like, frankly, is interesting to watch because of the way that it clashes with his
yeah.
talents.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, no, I'll stand up for those movies, but I just to let everybody know that's how into that aesthetic I was that I watched all of those terrible knockoffs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Another one, The Immortals.
Mm-mm.
That one went straight to DVD. Tia Carrera.
Aww. I love her.
Yeah, no. Joe Pantoliano.
Really?
Yeah, Eric Roberts. And
whoa.
That
is a product of its time.
And yeah, and Tony Curtis.
Pardon my coughing throughout this. I'm still hungover from last night. So you are getting some real-time podcasts here at Frost Christmas Today, listeners.
Well, they want the raw shit. That's mm-hmm. what they're here for.
I am literally drinking a raspberry lime Schweppes and hawking my brains out.
But there's one movie in this subgenre. I would not subject you to, and I don't think I could watch again. And it was written and directed by the son of Joey Bishop, you know, like sort of the appendix of the Rat Pack.
Okay.
He was like the comedian who hung out with Sinatra and those
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, his son, Larry Bishop, made a movie called Mad Dog Time. And basically, the guy used every connection he had in show business to get the movie made and to get the cast. It's got...
he just pulled every favor.
Oh, it's got Richard Dreyfuss, Gabriel Byrne, Dennis Leary, Jeff Goldblum, I think. It is the most unwatchable thing in human history.
Wow.
It is every line of dialogue is like that oft-lamented back to penal lore line.
Yeah.
And it's just people sitting in dark nightclubs saying those lines to each other until one of them shoots the other one.
Yeah.
It's unbearably terrible.
So I remember telling you about this earlier, but... we used to, whatever, my old punk rock friends, when we would watch B-movies, we had something we referred to as a leather pinata, and I'm not sure who came up with it, but it referred to a movie that was very high concept and had good stuff in it, but there was an impenetrably bad movie hiding that good stuff.
Right.
So you couldn't get to it. And I think, like, that concept very much shaped the way I feel about, like, one, I believe the audience is a tyrant and should usually be ignored. And two, I think movies that are bad a lot of times have a lot of value in them. There's good stuff on the inside that you just can't necessarily get to because they're wrapped in a shitty movie. I watch a lot of bad movies.
Okay. Well, you know, that's absolutely true, and we'll talk about some of those leather pinatas, but I will tell you now that Mad Dog Time is a leather pinata filled with shit. You get through the leather, right. and then shit pours down on, covers everybody.
Great.
The whole room.
Wow.
But you know what? It's that, you know what? Fuck it. Watch it. It's okay. That terrible. If you can get a hold of it, but don't blame me. It's all I'm saying.
I mean.
All right. So this long-ass digression is trying to defend myself from charges of being a masculinist knucklehead. And I'm saying I can't be anything else. That's what I was raised in. I was a soupy bath of Tarantino and Michael Bay, like a nutrient-rich slurry. It's all I know. I'm sorry. I don't know no better.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, and
you
the throat cleared. I did not.
Godmothers.
No.
Like I did.
I did not. Yeah. No. We're both from the Midwest, but I was a little more sheltered, I think, in my childhood.
Well, to be fair, all women from Indiana are already lesbians.
That's true.
It's just, even the heterosexual ones.
Right.
It's like the law. So it made me automatically.
All right. So all that out of the way, time for my list.
Yeah.
But
God, you didn't
that,
even hit your list yet.
I didn't hit our list. Well, we're doing
very
well.
You are so dominating this podcast with masculinist energy right now.
I haven't even named my movies yet. Come on. Then you can feel dominated by masculinity after you hear something. But the way that Amber vibes on the you know, gay... I'm a fan of gore, but, like, over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you
comic
can,
booky gore.
Yes. If you can make a body explode like a pinata, mm-hmm. I'm going to be very pleased.
Yeah.
That is, like, it's the shortcut. I'm going to like a movie if it does that, even if it isn't good.
I actually... I have, like, an aversion to torture porn, like a visceral aversion, not an artistic one. So I always prefer comic book gore because it's not...
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, it's artistic, it's stylized, it can be done in a very interesting way.
Well, yeah.
But
and
also, it doesn't make me feel like I am at risk of that. Right,
yeah.
To me.
Yeah, your body's not going to explode like that. Also, it rides... I think one of the most productive tensions in cinema is that line between horror and comedy,
mm-hmm.
you know, because like laughs, because comedy and horror kind of, they're both interested in surprising you. Right?
Yeah,
like that's the key engine of audience engagement. And they can like go between that and the body blowing up. It will always make me both grossed out a little bit, but also make me laugh.
Yeah.
So I love exploding bodies. I love that stuff. Dystopic sci-fi.
Sure.
Also big fan of that. And also, finally, the sort of idiosyncratic thing I like is really earnest political allegories and, like, agitprop stuff.
Yeah.
Like, because everything in the internet age, including my Twitter feed, is totally soaked in irony.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs four layers of irony to just protect themselves from just the shit river of media and events and, you know, like the fear of exposing their vulnerabilities. And I get that. I certainly
partake
in it.
We all have irony poisoning.
We do. And so when I see a filmmaker who's willing to just put, like, earnest political didacticism on the screen, I will always credit it. I will be like, you know what? Maybe it was heavy-handed, but frankly, I kind of liked it as heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Like a movie like Cloud Atlas
mm-hmm.
by the Wachowskis. I don't know if you saw
it. I didn't see it, no.
People laugh their balls off at how embarrassing that movie is. And they have a point because, you know, the book it's based on.
Yeah.
It stuff happens in like four or five different time frames. You know, like stuff from like the 1900s,
mm-hmm.
the future, present day, the mm-hmm. 30s. There are all these different stories. And the way they did that is that they had the same actors play different characters in all of these time frames.
Right.
But that meant that they would like race switch them.
Yeah.
And so, like, you had, like, Halle Berry playing a Korean woman.
Okay.
With, like, the eyes pushed back and stuff. And, like, Hugh Grant played a Korean guy. There's a whole thing in Korea in the super future, and all the white actors have, like, yellow face, basically.
Uh-huh.
And there's, like, blackface. There's reverse blackface.
It's not the best artistic decision.
No, it's cringe-inducing. And they kind of, like, make it even worse because at the end, when they do the credits, they show the face, like, all the different characters they play, like, in a grid on the... And you're like, ooh, was this the best idea? But that movie is so hard on its sleeve with its, like,
right.
kind of ideas of
yeah.
you know, radical empathy.
Yeah,
that I left the theater really, really kind of responding to it, even though I could intellectually say that there was a lot wrong with it. Same thing with Snowpiercer. I don't know if you saw Snowpiercer.
Yeah, I for political reasons, I found it very, like, I found, like, okay, so one of the reasons I love Mad Max, the new Mad Max movie so much, is, like, first of all, I love wacky races, and it definitely paid off on that. Like, you want it to look like that, you want it to look cool. But also, they realized, okay, if there's anything good in our horrible world right now, the bourgeoisie has it.
Yeah.
And so, we can't blow it up. We have to go get it and
right.
take it from them.
Yeah.
There is no frontier anymore.
Yeah.
We're not going to start a new utopia. We have to overthrow the bourgeoisie.
Right.
And so, to me, I would rather watch Mad Max.
No, I agree.
It's completely,
no, and it's a much better
yeah.
movie. It's, yeah. not, it's, not, it's not a contest. I mean, Mad Max Fury Road is a
yeah.
brilliant, brilliant film. And
I
yes, it has it has
it got
a better.
Recognized as a British
I know
film
that was
too.
Really great to
yeah.
see everybody like it, but it and it also, yeah, it had a it did even have a more like coherent and thought out politics to it.
Yeah,
and like in addition to like that recipe for yeah, you have to seize the means of production. You
yeah.
also have a really great sort of fairy tale recapitulation of primitive accumulation,
mm-hmm.
like the way that you know chieftain figures use you know religion and sort of ritual to
yeah.
sort of to ratify. Claiming control of scarce resources.
Yeah.
And no, it's great. But like, and Snowpiercer is very muddled, and that ending doesn't really make sense. And it's sort of like, that. You could argue that that's like weak tea liberalism, basically, or whatever. But just like, I don't know, just the.
It was ambitious.
It was ambitious, which
yeah.
is a thing I appreciate. And just the clarity of that car as like the allegorical vehicle.
Yeah.
You know, with like, they're all in the back eating the nutrient shit,
mm-hmm.
and then the different. The different train cars going
yeah.
up to the top, and then the little kids are in the machinery making it work.
It's like
it's just
it's
such
like
a complete metaphor that I appreciate.
Marxist,
yeah.
political cartoon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We,
that,
we
that
feed
that
you.
Yeah,
we feed
you,
all.
Yeah.
We rule you. We trick you. It's the wedding cake thing. Only
yeah.
it's a train, and I just
like
I appreciate how just perfect it is. It's such
yeah.
a perfect metaphor, and
it
yeah.
good.
And Chris Evans is actually decent in it.
Yeah.
He's not bad.
Oh, no, he's not bad.
He's
yeah.
he's one of the more talented hunks that
yeah.
we have in
yeah.
Hollywood.
Yeah. I have something that I referred to as the hunk conundrum between Paul Hardy, or no, Tom Hardy, and that guy that looks like Tom Hardy. But a not as good looking Tom Hardy. Oh, Channing Tatum. Well, here's the thing. Like, this is the hunk conundrum. Like, Channing Tatum is like a goobery looking Tom Hardy, but he's really charming.
Very charming.
And he's very, and he's like really, he's a good actor.
Yeah.
And he does weird things. Tom Hardy is like a physically perfect looking human being, but his acting abilities sort of extend to like, grunting?
Mm-hmm. Very grunt-heavy.
He's grunt-heavy role. He's getting typecasted for that grunt. And that is the hunk conundrum that I feel that we're sort of in right now, is that, like, oh, I realize I'm more attracted to the worst, to the worser of the actors, because I'm vain. Very vain, and I like a pretty man.
Well, the thing is that now in this current age where every aesthetic choice has to be justified by a virtue.
Yeah.
You can make an article about how your preference for the worst actor actually
yeah.
says something good about you as a person.
Yeah, I'm actually
you're actually
like
more
really,
feminist and
really,
more woke than
yeah.
anyone else.
I'm
because
so woke.
Because
I'm not
you
shallow.
Like the grunty guy.
I'm not shallow.
Yeah.
I'm not ableist.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm not going to prefer Channing Tatum just because he is an actor who can perform in a way that is entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would, yeah. No.
The
very,
Think
very
Piece
shallow.
Universe is basically, the modern, like, content economy seems to me to be just an extension of a line from the classic 90s film, PCU. I don't know if
oh,
you've ever seen
PCU.
That.
PCU.
Where
PCU
Jeremy Piven
great.
Plays a college student.
And once again,
and
another movie
like
where they had no idea
yeah.
how bad it was going to get.
Yeah. And a guy who, yeah, who looked like he was in his early 50s. Playing a college
yeah,
senior.
Christ.
It's like, couldn't they get, like, because the thing is, I think he's had a hairpiece since then.
I think he had
he has to have a piece now.
The plugs.
Yeah, he's got to have plugs or a piece. And yet, they couldn't give him that for when he was a college student. He's got, like, no hair in that movie. But anyway, he says at one point to the young freshman, after he was stunned to find out a guy was majoring in television, he said, "You can major in Game Boy if you know how to bullshit."
Yeah.
And that's basically the content economy. If you can fucking sell it, you can, like, put out any fucking thesis, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay, so finally, we're finally down to my list that I've done as much as possible to deflect to the end so nobody judges me for these goddamn choices. So we got a couple of overlaps, Network, RoboCop. I'm going to start off with a weird double feature from the late 80s, early 90s, and you could make a strong argument that these are just movies that I saw as a kid and so are sort of immune from criticism for me.
Sure.
But I really believe that I can look back at those movies, like Spaceballs, a movie I loved. I can look back at that and say, it's not that good.
I know what I liked about it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that great. But these are movies that I go back to and I watch them again and I, God damn it, these are good movies. I don't care. And they're both, in my mind, it's the greatest 1-2 punch by an American director in terms of like two movies that came out like 1 year and then the next that I can imagine. And that is The Burbs and Gremlins 2, The New Batch, by Joe Dante, one of the most underrated directors in American history.
Yo, they're showing the Gremlins 2 at BAM right now.
No!
Yeah, you can see it on the big screen.
God damn it, that's awesome. Way to go, BAM, because Gremlins 2 is brilliant.
Yeah, no, it's so good.
Gremlins 2 is brilliant. It's, like, Gremlins, the first one, is a fun, good movie. I like it.
Yeah,
but
also
Gremlins
one of the
2,
great Christmas movies.
Right, and, like, the dire thing about sequels is that everyone has decided the sequel should just be the first movie bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And Dante was like, no, we're going to do the whole thing.
We're going to
make a movie about making the Gremlins movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, John Glover, fantastic performances, sort of an amalgam of Donald Trump and Ted Turner as Daniel Clamp. You got the Clamp Center, this talking building that's actually like this hell state of late capitalism where like everything, all the things talk to you with this like bright, shiny voice while the building is being filled with these monsters who are killing everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good. But The Burbs is also amazing.
The Burbs is good.
One of the best Tom Hanks performances in my mind.
I haven't seen it since a very long time.
It's on Netflix. It'll go off and on Netflix. I think it's on Netflix now. So I would recommend checking it out. It's got a great supporting performance by Rick Dukeman, sadly dead now. Fat Canadian comedian as Tom Hanks' sort of running buddy in that movie. Amazing Bruce Dern performance as this sort of touched Vietnam veteran. And it's got one of the great, like, performances of frustration moments. There's a scene in that movie where Tom Hanks has found out that the creepy neighbors who he thinks are murderers know that he's looking into them. And he runs into the house. He tries to run into his house. And his wife opens the door and he smacks him in the head. And he's just standing there with his head, and he's, like, really mad, you can tell, and he's in pain. And his wife says to him, "Are you okay, honey?" And he grabs two empty beer cans and just crushes them in his hands and then throws them down. And she goes, "You feel better now?" And he goes, "Yeah, kind of." And I just love that they put that in there. Because, like, that's what you do when you're really mad.
And the futility.
Just the futile, sad, suburban
and domestication.
Rage.
Yeah.
The sad suburban. Because that movie is largely about, like, anxiety about suburbanization and sort of how you're domesticated by it. Anyway, two really great movies. A great double feature for anybody who wants a good Saturday or Friday night. RoboCop, we talked about. I am a Coen Brothers boy because of I Can't Not Be. My demographics basically make it required. I'm a college graduate.
Yeah.
I'm a male college graduate who grew up sometime in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
A white. I can't not like the Coens.
I do like the Coens, but I do feel... I feel obliged to, like, push back on Coen love.
No, I get it.
Was the last one I saw.
It was Hail Caesar.
I saw Hail Caesar. Yeah, no, I saw that in the theater. And I realized, like, I have this thing where it's, like, here are these, like, this couple of, like, very literary Jews with, like, a fantasy of a mystical middle American kind of masculinity. and like kind of these like dopey yet noble like rubes. And I don't like find it offensive or anything, but it's like, man, you guys really like what you like.
They do, and I think that's one of the reasons I really like them, is because
they like they mystical have a very, Christianity in well, a weird way.
Yeah, well, yeah, they have a very interesting relationship
or
to religion.
Or their Christian subjects.
Well, I think that they, because if you look at the movie, their movie that kind of deals directly with Judaism, A Serious Man,
mm-hmm.
I think there is a weird sort of sense maybe of awe or envy or about Christianity, and it's the way that it's willing
to be like
it's willing
Methodist
to open you
farm boy.
Right. It's
yeah.
like it will open the mysteries up to you in a way Judaism will
I
not.
I think in some ways maybe also you might like them a little bit because they flatter you.
Well, yeah, I'm smart enough to get it.
That's fine. That's totally fine.
I get to walk out
I
of a
like
movie feeling smart, and I had fun.
Yeah, I like that they love, you know, Midwestern, like, you know, whatevers. And I think their affection for their subjects is very real and very dear. But I do find it, I feel like it goes unquestioned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I love the Coens.
No, I love the Coens. And I
love that they love me and my people and where I come from,
but
too.
I respond,
but it is weird, because they're totally not us at all.
Right. Well, they grew up amongst us, though.
They did, but they have, so did fucking Garrison Keillor. By the way, Garrison Keillor is, like, he grew up evangelical. He was not a...
Wait a minute, he wasn't a, like, Sunday Lutheran
No, he was not a Lutheran
guy?
At all.
Motherfucker.
Yeah.
That motherfucker.
I know. And
Garrison
so,
Keillor isn't a Lutheran. This is the biggest shock that I have encountered
in a long goddamn time.
I will
tell you so much. He's also like got like a Central Park West apartment. He's been divorced 4 times or something. He's a bitchy New York Jew who isn't a bitchy New York Jew. I also like love Garrison Keillor's writing and will defend him, even though Prairie Home Companion
is unlistenable garbage.
Yeah.
It's unlistenable garbage. I'm glad we're on the same page on that.
But yeah, there is something about someone. But I'll still listen to it.
Well, that's
because
too far for
I
me.
Realize
I
I'm like I like that you flatter me and that you watch me and that you get something about me.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously, the Coens are better at that.
Yeah.
And
I respond to all the references that I get to feel smart for getting.
Yeah.
I respond to the worldview, the sort of like grim existentialism. That's why I think their best movie is...
Yeah, I cannot figure out... I like also that I'm not completely aware of what they believe, or if they believe the universe is complete chaos, or...
I suspect that they do.
There's a lot of argument about
but
that.
But they want... I mean, you see the way
because
that...
Because they like mysticism.
They do love mysticism, but, like, the question is sort of, is the mysticism... are they expressing
a
mystical...
Well, in Brother Warat, though, it was actually, I think, the most... meaningful of that because it was the best statement on that. I think it's sort of like because it was in the realm of sort of Greek myth, and it's like there are gods, they don't care about you.
Yeah, I mean that's a recurring theme, but then like the hand of God shows up in their movies a lot, like
mm-hmm.
like but I do wonder is it the hand of God in like a literal sense, or is it a meta god? Is it them? Is it film? Like,
yeah.
There's a degree to which their films are all sort of...
And I like that it's
sort of
self-references enough, but I'm not sure.
And are
yeah.
all film-based. Like,
yeah.
you could make a strong argument that all Coen Brothers movies are really just about filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, and so all these, like, this stuff about the mystery and this stuff about God, it's really about making movies. You
yeah.
could make that. And they keep it ambiguous.
They're life of the mind guys.
They really are. But it's very ambiguous, and it's always, like, where they are, and it seems to switch from movie to movie. Like, are they talking about... Are they making a statement about the world, or are they making a statement
yeah.
about movies? And it kind of can be both. Sometimes it's one or the other.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting. And I'd say, but I was saying, I really like their sort of, their existential approach to humanity. And like that, their view that like people have to sort of just accept their decisions. And they judge their characters harshly, but usually due to their actions. Like they take free will very seriously. And that's why I think, like, I probably enjoy Big Lebowski the most because, once again, I'm contractually obligated to based on my demographic profile.
Yeah.
But I think their best movie, just in terms of a front-to-back piece of work, is Miller's Crossing.
Really?
I really love Miller's Crossing. That last shot after he's done all of this shit, got all these guys killed, didn't even go back with Albert Finney's gang, ruins his relationship, and he's just standing next to this tree, and he just puts his hat on, the hat that he'd been dreaming about chasing throughout the whole movie,
yeah.
And just cocks it back a little bit, and he's got this, like, weird little smile, just this sense that, like, even though he did things against his own self-interest throughout the course of this film, he did things according to his own weird ideas, and that
yeah.
sort of ratifies the whole thing.
I will say my biggest sort of Coen memory. I saw The Big Lebowski in theaters with my mother. Very progressive mom, and she at some point in the movie goes. She was never kidnapped. And, like, she, like, leans over and was just like, she was never kidnapped. And I'm like, no, she wasn't. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then she's like, she was never kidnapped. And I'm like, shut up. And she schooled me hard.
She did. Like, mom owned you.
Yeah. Mom
owned told you. Told you. She kidnapped herself.
Yeah.
Just so yourself. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. With some more controversial takes. This time, we're going to talk about some movies. Some classics that maybe...
You want to hear how you're going to die, Holiday?
First, I'm going to shoot you in the stomach. And then I'm going to shatter both your shin bones with two more bullets. And when you're almost dead, I'm going to blow your brains out.
I'm just going to shoot you once in the forehead and then go home.
A life in crime can be crazy.
Consider yourself... back on the payroll.
But with the head of the mob coming back...
Vic is getting out.
Vic is getting out.
Vic's getting out.
Things are really gonna get... insane.
Vic's out of the funny farm, yeah!
Welcome home, Vic. Can you join us for a round of Thorazine?
It's funny.
Send a thank you note to Jake Parker.
And anyone who doesn't like it...
I want you to be very nice to Ben, but if he gives you any trouble, shoot him.
...will just have to bite the bullet.
Oh, no.
But that's the way it's gotta be, Ben, my way.
Oh, no.
Yeah, my way.
Okay.
United Artists Pictures presents...
I thought you should know. Sleepy Joe. He got his brains blown in. In fact, he's dead.
A story of power...
It's mad dog time.
Betrayal.
You've been seeing Rita in the night and me in the day?
Nobody two times me! Two times!
And sex.
I hope you don't crash!
You two times me two times!
In other words...
Thank you all for coming.
The whole shooting match.
What is my philosophy of life, Dick?
I hear he's quick in the trigger. I hear the neck is quicker than Mick, and that Mick isn't as quick as Nick. I hit Nick over Mick.
I ran out of people to kill me.
Don't look at me, I just ran out of bullets.
Ellen Barkin, Gabriel Byrne, Richard Dreyfuss, Jeff Goldblum, Diane Lane, Larry Bishop, Gregory Hines, Kyle MacLachlan, Burt Reynolds.
Ben, go home, pack your bags, and leave town.
Nobody tells me what to do.
Ow! Ben, hop home, pack your bags, and leave town.
Is that you talking, Vic? Or is it the medication?
Ow! Ben, roll home, pack your bags, and leave town.
We're back, and now it's the time of the show where we air some grievances with classic cinema, movies that are widely beloved, but we're here to tell you, not so fast, buddy. So, Amber, what's your take on a classic film that you do not enjoy?
Okay, so this is... I want to stress that this is not for any moral reasons. I think this man is disgusting, but I love Roman Polanski films, and he is an actual horrible rapist.
He is.
So this is not moral films, or moral reasons, or moral aversion, but I don't like most Woody Allen at all.
Whoa.
What I do like, I know, it's terrible, too, especially because, like, at this point, I've realized my entire dating pool, the men that are attracted to me in this city, are his audience. So I'm... just, yeah, I'm really self-sabotaging here. I like Borscht Belt comedy Woody Allen. I love Love and Death. I think it's very funny. A lot of people don't like that. And this is not, I like his earlier work. But, like, I hate Annie Hall.
Boom! That's right, folks. You heard it here first.
I hate Annie Hall. I also think it's really fucking weird that we recognize the trope of the manic pixie dream girl, and don't realize that, like, Annie Hall is, like, the gestation of that.
She wears boys' clothes. It's crazy. She's got a little bowler hat.
Oh my god. I just can't. I think honestly, it's like the first movie that a lot of people, specifically like a lot of men, maybe saw where everything didn't just get like tied up all neat and tidy in the end. It's like before they discovered French cinema or something. And so they have this affection for it for that reason. But I don't think it holds up. But I think if you rewatch it, I think it's kind of just like a self-indulgent fucking Woody Allen. I don't care. I also hate Hannah and Her Sisters. Like, I fucking hate those movies. Yeah, so that's me.
There you
go,
folks.
Yeah.
You might want to turn off the show now if you're a Woody head. I know that I'm personally... I can't believe she'd say that about the Woody man's movies. They're so fantastic. It's just...
This is going to destroy all my romantic prospects in the city for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Okay, I will go to the other part, too.
Yeah. You might have to move to, like, a...
Yeah, I'll have to move
Peoria
back to the Midwest. Yeah. But the other thing, and this is more of a genre thing, I think people think that most silent movies are, like, Alita, Queen of Mars, or, like, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. No. Most silent movies are, like, The Swarthy Bohunk has tied Fair Elizabeth to the train tracks. Like, most silent movies were, like, you know, some carnival barker trying to be Michael Bay who bought a toy who, you know, wasn't involved in theater or anything at all. He was just trying to create an attraction. And a lot of silent movies, really bad. Very bad. And a lot of them were okay, but would have been better with sound.
Yeah, they absolutely would have.
Yeah.
I mean, the craftsmen of the best silent films, if you could give them, like, a red digital camera or, like, IMAX, they'd be like, fucking finally.
Here's the
I'm
thing.
I'm sick of shooting this thing on a goddamn, like, daguerreotype or whatever.
Here's the thing that you know. Sometimes movies still get shot in black and white because people are like, oh, this is an effect that creates a certain mood. No one is making fucking silent movies still. Except for that one novelty thing, The Artist, but that, like, one...
That was everyone's aunt's favorite movie for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then they forgot about it.
It's a joke of a movie. It's just, like...
Guy Madden does that, too, the weird Canadian guy. He does, like, shit with, like... But, once again, it's not silent. It's, like, it's stylized. It has modern shit in it to make it watchable.
Yeah.
Because that shit was largely unwatchable, because they were working with what they had.
A Trip to the Moon.
Yeah.
I have my students watch that. It's incredibly beautiful.
I mean, they fucking electric. They had nothing to do.
Caligari.
They literally electrocuted a fucking elephant so that they could have something to put on screen.
Yeah, that was Edison.
Yeah.
He also would just, like, wander into, you know... He filmed, like, also, like, his favorite stripper. By the way, stripper technology has just improved so much.
Oh, yeah. You see, even, like, those 50s, like, cutie movies where they're dancing, it's like, ugh.
No, I mean, there's just been,
leaps
and bounds in the industry.
Was anyone aroused by this?
They were!
The lady with, like pie plate-sized pasties on her nipples, like, vaguely kind of doing a hula.
Oh my god,
like,
Edison's favorite.
Like, that's the kind of shit that, like, Jack Ruby was like, doing at the Carousel Club.
Edison's favorite stripper, by the way, was, like, a strong woman, too, who would just, like, strip down to her Victorian skivvies or whatever, which came up to her neck and, like, do awkward flips on a trapeze.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was a lot of what silent felt like. By all means,
a visit to the opium den.
Yeah.
That means, like, some asshole got a bunch of, like, Chinese peaked caps. on sale and like put them on people's heads and like, all right, you're all on opium.
Just like look strung
just
out.
Just look high, yeah.
Yeah. No,
but like a lot of people like to say that they have historical value, which they do.
Oh, of course.
And they like to say things like, well, it's the first time someone did a lap dissolver. It's the first time a camera panned. But it's
when
like, of course, there's going to be a
first
time.
The first time someone believes, does something, why would we believe that that would be any good at all?
Yeah, it's by definition going to be pretty bad because no one's ever done it before.
There's a lot of, there's some great, there's a great Italian one that's based off of an Edgar Allan Poe thing, and mainly it's all leading up to maybe perhaps the first gross, gory special effect ever done, and it's good. It looks good.
Yeah.
But also it's 12 minutes long.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason why there's not, most silent film is very bad.
Yeah.
It's just like,
sorry, dudes who go to movie theaters where they have a guy playing the organ to recreate the original experience, and you're wearing spats. All right, and now I'll do a little bit of heresy here. I've got one movie that, frankly, I can't even know at this point if anyone's even going to care that I say that I didn't like it, because this was a movie that was worshipped a few years ago when it came out as this like bold new visionary effort by an independent filmmaker, won Oscar nominations and was widely regarded. And now, the filmmaker has not made anything since then, and I have not heard anybody reference this movie positively or negatively since the Oscar season that it was nominated in ended. So I kind of feel vindicated by that silence. So I kind of feel like that's not even really heresy, but I just want to vent the fact that Beasts of the Southern Wild sucks. It is this really precious attempt to, like, basically make the dire poverty of people in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana beautiful.
Nope.
And it's like,
already not interested.
It's not good.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, it's just grating is what it is. It's
like
it wants to do this, it wants to have it both ways. It wants to feel gritty and realistic, and it wants to be
heartwarming.
And kind of heartwarming and also transformative or like aesthetically elevated. And it ends up just being really grating mess.
Yeah.
But then the more classic movie, and of course it'll be a genre film because I'm a pig, is Blade Runner.
Whoa.
I'm sorry.
Bitch, get out.
I'm sorry. I don't like Blade Runner. Haven't seen the right cut. Maybe there's a Phantom cut out there that's seven hours
long.
There
are multiple cuts.
I literally don't know which one I've seen. I've probably seen it several times in different
voiceover?
Cuts. I think I saw it, the last time I saw it, I don't think it had voiceover, which is the good one, right? The one without voiceover?
Yeah.
The good one. I still don't like it. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's crazy.
I mean,
I want to know what you don't like about it.
There's good parts about it. Like, Rutger Hauer's great. The Roy Batty, the speech at the end is fantastic. It looks really nice, but I guess maybe it's because I saw it too late, and like, I feel like a lot of people found that aesthetic really transporting, and for me,
aesthetic.
Right, but I feel like I'm looking at it like through a bunch of all its imitators, and so I can't kind of see what people saw at the time to make it feel so good. I'm just like, that's an okay matte painting or whatever. It just doesn't, it's everything so dark, and I'm like, that seems kind of contrived. And Harrison Ford
like
doesn't
noir?
Really do anything for me. I like noir, but I don't know. I honestly think that a lot of it just stems from the fact that I have a real aversion and, frankly, resentment of Ridley Scott.
Ooh.
I feel like he's a fucking hack. And, like, his reputation basically stands on Alien and Blade Runner. And I just feel like if I can cut one of those struts out, the whole goddamn thing will fall over. Because I feel like he hasn't really made
Alien.
A movie. No, Alien is great.
Yeah.
First, great. And that's, like, that's the one he's got. But, like, look what he did. Look at fucking Prometheus. Look what he did to his own legacy.
Yeah.
You know, it does just feel like, he's getting older. But, like, he's a guy who should have retired 20 years ago and wasn't that good before that. And I feel like every time I see Blade Runner get praised, it's just one more thing keeping Ridley Scott relevant. Which
bold,
he does not deserve.
That's
so, yeah, there you
bold.
Go. Annie Hall and Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Boom.
Ugh.
All okay.
Right.
Well, as I said, the cards are on the table. You know who you're dealing with. You can unsubscribe now if these takes are too hot. But we will be
this
back.
This is by no means a comprehensive list for either
of
us.
Of course not. These are just things
we
that
just
came to mind,
wanna,
things
like,
we love.
If we're going to send you a little sampler of our tastes, we
yeah.
thought you could know all this moving forward.
Exactly.
And know what you're signing up for.
Yeah. So we'll see you guys next week with some more movies filtered through the fractured takes that we have to offer. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.